You're listening to Investigation Insiders by Integris Intelligence.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Investigation Insiders. This is Farhad. Hope you are all well and safe. As always, thank you for your time and support. I'm really excited about today's episode. I know I sound like a broken record, but we have another terrific guest today, a retired FBI agent and principal of Buckley Peterson Global, my friend Ed Peterson. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. You know, I'm sure a lot of the people that are listening to this episode probably know you anyway, but maybe we can start with a broad overview of your career.
Sure. As far as my background, I came into the FBI in the late 60s when J. Edgar Hoover was the director. It was a long-term goal to be an FBI agent. I wrote a letter to Mr. Hoover when I was in high school, and things fell into place, and sure enough, my dream came true, and I became an FBI agent, and it was everything I hoped it would be.
And you were there for how long, Ed?
As far as my career in the FBI, I spent almost 28 years as an FBI agent. After the FBI, I became the director of security for Major League Baseball for about 4.5 years. And then from there, started my own security consultant company with a very close friend. And we've been working together for over 20 years. That's Jim Buckley, who was the former police commander of the Patterson Police Department.
Yeah, but another great man. Ed and I met many years ago through mutual friends and colleagues, and we've had the good fortune of exchanging ideas, resources, and working together on a few things. And one thing I've always admired about Ed is his ability to bring people together and stay connected. It's actually something I've watched and learned from. So not sure if you knew that, but I wanted to share that with you, Ed.
Well, thank you, Farhad. I appreciate you saying that.
So, you know, if it's okay, I mean, I'd like to ask sort of a couple of questions. So where'd you actually grow up, when you were a kid?
Well, you could probably tell by this accent that I'm not from the Deep South. I was born in Jersey City and grew up in Hudson County, Union City, North Bergen, and just had a great childhood. Loved the urban area that I grew up in, and went to school in Jersey City at Jersey City State College. And my friends at college used to tease me because it was basically a teacher's college. And I would tell them that I'm going to be an FBI agent one day, and they'd be holding their credentials, their lapel of their jacket, calling me a junior G-man. And I said, well, someday you'll see. And sure enough, I graduated, went on, got my master's degree, took the test for the FBI and passed it, and the rest is history. And we had a lot of laughs in those days, but my goal of being an agent was fulfilled.
You know, it's something interesting I got to tell you. Almost exclusively, we've had a lot of former or retired FBI agents on the show, and almost everyone, I believe, up to this point has said, you know, it wasn't something that they aspired to. It almost happened by circumstance that they became an FBI agent. You're actually the first person that not only wanted to be an FBI agent, but sought it out. So your story about writing a letter to Mr. Hoover, I actually didn't know that. So tell me about what you wrote in that letter, if you remember.
Well, it was a handwritten letter, and it was about 2 pages long. And I told him, Director Hoover, that I would like to learn everything I could about the FBI and one day become an FBI agent, and wanted to know any suggestions that anyone could give me, so I would be on the right path. And sure enough, I got a beautiful letter back, and it was from the at the time the SAC, the special agent in charge of Newark, and he provided me with some information. So that my letter was answered, and I felt I knew what I had to do.
That's an incredible story. Do you still have that letter by any chance?
You know, I did have that letter up until a few years ago, when I don't know where it is now, but I had saved it for many, many years.
Yep. Oh, that's a really neat story. Did you ever get a chance to speak to Mr. Hoover about that, or?
Yeah. Yes, I did. Actually, he was supposed to greet us when we graduated with our graduating class from the FBI Academy, but something came up, and one of his assistant directors had spoken to us at the graduation of our class, which was at the old Academy in Quantico, not the the academy where everyone graduates over the last many, many years. We were at the Marine Corps base, and the FBI had a small area there where we had our academy and classes, and then they brought us up to Washington, D.C., actually for, you know, the graduation part to meet, hopefully, Mr. Hoover, but he was not available. But I did meet him one time in the old post office building when he was there, and we did get a chance to see his office when we were in training school. They brought us in one day, and they showed all the new attendees at the academy Mr. Hoover's office in Washington, D.C., and it was amazing. It was, the as you would expect, it was just meticulous. I mean, everything was in such orderly fashion, and it was exciting to see it.
I'll tell you, this is one of the most interesting stories I think I've heard. You know, obviously there's the work that you guys did, but just from a personal perspective, that's really neat. And by the way, I am not surprised that that's how you became, well, that's part of your process in becoming a FBI agent. You have certainly always been a go-getter as far as I knew you. So that's a really interesting story. So I guess with all of the people you've known over the years, right? And I know this is a pretty unfair question. Is there someone that sticks out in your mind, whether it be family, friends, a colleague, that has sort of influenced you to become the person that you are?
Well, I have to say, believe it or not, from a young boy, I had a tremendous love for basketball. And my coaches, my high school coach was the one who convinced me to go to college. And my college coach, my dad had died when he was in his 40s. And my college coach was like, both of those guys were like fathers. They both were great mentors, and you know, they always encouraged me to you know, pursue any goals or in life that I had. And my high school coach has passed on many years ago, but my college coach is in his 90s, and we get together maybe once a month, once every 5 or 6 weeks. He's not as mobile as he'd like to be, but we always have a great time, you know, sharing memories. And they were people that took such an interest in me and motivated me and put me in a position to achieve a lot of the goals. And then along the way, you get the honor to work with, I was assigned to some veteran FBI agents, Joe Conway and Bill Roselli and Bob Hartman, and people that just, I learned so much from them. I would always try to take Bill Rizzelli had some great interview techniques. Joe Conway was terrific. They had different styles. And I always tried to take and learn from them. I learned, you know, they were both great report writers, very right to the point and not, you know, writing a lot of with a lot of French pastry and no substance. They would get right to the point of what needed to be said. And, you know, you observe the guys and you say, you know, there's things that he does that I can learn from and make me a better agent. And I attribute guys like that in the FBI. And I have to tell you, as great as a job as being a director of security with Major League Baseball, which was so exciting, yeah. I went to Cuba with the Orioles. I was in Caracas, Venezuela with the Braves, Australia with the Olympics when we won the gold medal in 2000, and traveled all over the world with baseball and had so many wonderful experiences. Working with the NFL was a great experience, being on the field for a Super Bowl and being one of the representatives with the New York Giants. That was a great experience. But nothing, in my opinion, could match being an FBI agent. And the people that I worked with the FBI were of such high quality and character and ethically, just strong and strong with integrity. And just what the letters imply, fidelity, bravery, integrity, FBI. Unfortunately, we have seen the FBI and the Bureau fall out of the graces of the public. The perception of the FBI is not very good these days. And I think you got to lay blame where it belongs with the leadership. It's not, unfortunately, what it should be. The FBI has unfortunately taken on a political approach, it appears, and it's disheartening to talk to young agents and colleagues from the FBI and to see all the negative publicity that the FBI is receiving these days, when everyone in my era was so important about protecting the integrity of the FBI. No one was allowed to put political signs on their property or anything. Unfortunately, things have changed. But I think I'm a very optimistic guy. And I really know that the mission of the FBI is so important, the work that the FBI does. And you have so many great FBI agents. And I hope they stop bringing in people from the outside, because that's when I think the Bureau kind of lost their way. They bought, years ago, they would promote from within, and people earned those positions, and they carried on the great traditions of the FBI. Today, unfortunately, you have people coming in from the outside that have their own political agendas. So that's changed the face of the FBI. But I really believe that the reputation of the FBI will be restored when we have the right people leading it.
Yeah, no, you said a lot there. First, just to start off at some of your beginning comments about your basketball coaches and your father having passed away at a young age, and how they took sort of a leadership role, almost a father role in your life. Again, for me, it was very similar. So there's a lot that resonates with me when you talk about that. And it's amazing that you and it speaks to your character. I mean, are still talking about that and are still connecting with those same folks. And I'm doing something similar. But and then, you know, like the people in the FBI that you cited that sort of helped you become the agent that you were. I mean, it's just really amazing that you remember those sorts of things, because a lot of times people, you know, do, and we all learn from someone, good, bad, or indifferent. We all learn from people, and people oftentimes forget that. So it's really neat that, again, you're recognizing those kinds of things. And then obviously from your time at the FBI. One of my next questions to you was going to be, what are some of the things that stick out to you from your time in the FBI? And almost every time I ask people that question, they always say the people. So I'm going to throw that out there to you. What are some of the most memorable things from your time with the FBI?
Well, I think that's a good point, Farhad. It's so true. The people of the FBI, I worked with wonderful people with Major League Baseball, just terrific people. The same with the NFL. My experience with the NFL, wonderful people that you deal with. But there was something unique about the FBI. I think the mission of the bureau. The loyalty that was instilled, and that again seems to be something that's lacking today. I mean, we were always so careful. When I came in as a new agent, you always hear the old timers would say, "Don't embarrass the FBI. Don't ever embarrass the FBI." And that was ingrained in my mind that you never wanted to do anything that would embarrass the bureau. And I think that was so important. And I think that value was shared with so many of the FBI agents that I had the honor and pleasure of working with. They took such pride in their work. And the support people of the FBI that helped were so important in building cases that would go to trial. We always relied on one another, and it was just such a sense of teamwork, and I feel that's so important, and we've got to get back to those values. I believe we will.
Sure. No, I mean, all just really neat points. So just for our audience, I've been wanting to get Ed on the show for a while now. So I'm glad we got it off the ground. Actually, we had a case recently where we assisted a couple in locating their son who went missing. That was part of the inspiration for the show because Ed's actually worked on a number of cases which involve lost or missing or kidnapped or wanted people. And one of those people, which is a pretty well-known case, was Seymour Pinckney. And so, Ed, can you talk a little bit about who Seymour Pinckney was and
Yeah,
what he was accused of?
it's a fascinating case because he was a fugitive, not of the FBI. He was a fugitive from the Patterson Police Department. I'll back up and give you a little background on the case. In June of 1978, a 16-year-old girl named Franchern Smith. She reports to the Patterson Police Department that she was being assaulted and molested and beaten by her mother's common law husband by the name of Seymour Pinckney. Now, the police placed her in protective custody in the Passaic County Youth Shelter, and she had written a very descriptive, emotional letter to her social worker, crying out for help for her sisters. And Pinckney, at the time, he was about 38 years old, strong built guy, a handyman, a brick mason by trade, and a very heavy drinker, a volatile, bad temper, just a very nasty guy. And Franchern described how he had beaten her and her sisters, sexually assaulted them, bullied them, and just in general terms, was just a very nasty guy. And that was in June of 78. In August of 78, the Patterson Police Department charged him with sexual assault. And when the Patterson detectives went to the residence where he was staying with the girls and his common law wife, nobody was there. He was missing. The mother was missing. The one sister was missing. And the detectives became very suspicious. They checked with neighbors and they found out that the mother, whose name was Vera Smith, and her daughter, Jocelyn, who was 18 years old at the time, had not been seen for more than 2 weeks. The detective who did a terrific job, her name was Leona Robinson, worked for Jim Buckley, who was the police commander. She became very suspicious, and she started, you know, she looked around the house, and she made a great observation. There was a detached garage, and she walked into the detached garage, and she saw that there was freshly laid concrete over a dirt floor, and that certainly aroused her suspicion. It was a little bit of a challenge. The judges, you know, at first didn't think there was enough probable cause, but the Patterson detectives were persistent and eventually got a search warrant. And they brought in some heavy equipment and they removed the concrete. And sure enough, the bodies of Vera Smith and her daughter, Jocelyn, both had been shot in the chest several times, and they were buried in the dirt under that concrete.
Oh.
Patterson Police Department, you know, immediately got arrest warrants for him. And they had several what looked like to be promising leads, but nothing ever panned out. And the case just went on and on, one dead end after another. And 10 years later, more than 10 years, almost 11 years later, when Jim Buckley became the commander, we had a great friendship. He approached me and asked me if I could get a federal unlawful flight warrant. That's under Title 18, Section 1073, unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And probably around the late 89, we did get a federal warrant, and that enabled us to work very closely with the Patterson Police Department, because now we had federal jurisdiction as well as the state jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And we started to develop some leads, and we wound up with a wiretap with someone we found out that he had been in periodic contact with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the Philadelphia area. And we were able to trace calls to Virginia. And those calls to Virginia were payphones, basically at a truck stop. So now we were looking at the possibility, because this guy was definitely a drifter. I mean, he had no, other than doing odd and end jobs as a brick mason and a painter and other things, we figured maybe he was an over-the-road truck driver, because these calls were all made from truck stops in the Richmond, Virginia area.
Mm-hmm.
So then Jimmy asked me, you know, we talked about the direction of the case, and we decided to take a shot with America's Most Wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a tremendous track record, because prior to this case, the longest FBI fugitive at the time was another New Jersey case, a guy by the name of John Emil List, who killed five members of his family and just so callously had called the school to tell them the children were going to be out of school for a while. They had a death in the family and they had to go visit relatives out of state. But meanwhile, he had propped up the five bodies in the house that he lived in Westfield, New Jersey. And it took 18 years and America's Most Wanted. He had started a brand new life, moved, but a neighbor had recognized a photo of him. We didn't even have fingerprints of him or anything, because he was had never been arrested before. But after that show, And when they were able, because of that show, we were able to arrest John Emil List. That left a very strong impression on me, as well as a Jim Buckley. And we decided to take a shot with America's Most Wanted. They were receptive to taking the case. And I could tell you the exact details. The case was presented, I believe, let me just see the date. It was October 22nd, 1989. It was a Sunday evening. Myself, Jim Buckley, and another FBI agent by the name of Hoyt Peavy, we drove down to Washington, D.C., and met with John Walsh, who was just a terrific guy, such a pro-law enforcement guy. And it's interesting. I'll give you a little background how it works. They have approximately 25, 30 college students answering phones. Mm. And John Walsh presents the cases. That night, I think he presented two or three cases with the highlight of Sidney Seymour Pinckney. But what was interesting in this case, it was one of the very first cases that through the Bureau and one of the Bureau officials, we had the suggestion of trying to use the FBI's new system of computer enhancement of the photograph, taking into consideration the lifestyle of Sidney Seymour Pinckney, that he was a heavy drinker, a heavy smoker, what he might look like, you know, from the days when the murder was committed 10, 11 years later. And that was one of the very first cases. I remember they did a big article on it in Red Book magazine after he was arrested. And the way it worked, Fahad, was interesting. The college students have a series of questions. And that night, I think they probably had 200 to 300 phone calls.
Wow.
And the questions that the college students ask are, when and where did you see the fugitive? Why do you believe it's him? What was he doing? Where is he now? What else can you tell me about the fugitive? And if those questions, when they ask them, all sound very logical, they raise their hand and an FBI agent or a detective would go over to the individual who had received the call and put you on the phone with the caller. Sure enough, that night, we got four or five calls that were substantive phone calls that identified Seymour Pinckney, and they all described him in the same way, that he was a handyman, a painter. One individual had the address where he was staying. Two people gave us a great descriptive data on the station wagon that he was driving. So we felt pretty good about it. We immediately notified the Virginia FBI office down in Richmond, the Richmond FBI office, the Virginia State Police, who had been working with us on the case, and the local authorities. And they went to the residence. This is right during the show, right when the case was presented. Believe this is incredible. He had been watching the show. Seymour Pinckney saw himself on America's Most Wanted, didn't even bother to turn the TV off, left it onto the station where the show had appeared, grabbed whatever he needed to grab. He was living in like a rooming house, and took off. Hmm. And about an hour or so later, a sheriff's deputy who had a civilian with him on a ride along, they had seen the show and they observe a guy going into a store. It was like a 7-Eleven, I believe it was the Little Sioux convenience store. And they see this guy going in, and it was the civilian said, "That looks just like the guy they showed on America's Most Wanted." And they had descriptive data on the car. The sheriff's deputy got out of the car, pulled his gun, and Seymour Pinckney unknowingly came out of the store with his both arms filled with groceries. He was preparing to take off, and the sheriff's deputy called for backup. Unfortunately, the backup didn't arrive in time, so he wound up. He was very fortunate. I think the Seymour Pinckney didn't realize that the civilian was a civilian. He probably thought he was another police officer. Huh. And he handcuffed Seymour Pinckney. He had a gun in his waistband and two more guns in his car. And so it was a terrific arrest, and it was great for the family, the survivors, to know that justice was finally answered and served after almost 13 years of him being a fugitive.
And that's an incredible account of, you know, our show is called Investigation Insider. So, you know, the premise when we started it was to peel the layers back on things that happened, and so you just captured that like exactly as we had intended. So that is really just an unbelievable case. Is that where you met Jim, or were you guys friends from even before that? Like,
well, we were friends because when we opened the FBI office up in West Patterson, Garrett Mountain,
yeah,
Jim had become the commander, and he had a great reputation. I had worked a couple of great cases with Jim, a major kidnapping in Patterson, where we recovered the victim and safe and sound, and arrested the five individuals involved in the kidnapping. And you know, we just developed a good friendship. We had good chemistry, and working together. And when Jim approached me on this case, it was a no-brainer. I said, this is a case that the FBI should be involved with. And with just great teamwork, and just a lot of good relationships were built because of cases like this.
You know, so a couple of things. One, I used to watch the show quite a bit. And, you know, in preparation for speaking with you today, I sort of looked at like what happened to the show. And then, you know, I was thinking about like how successful it was, because this is just one of many, many, many cases that, you know, the show was able to solve. And I'm like, you know, thinking, why isn't this show around anymore? And I guess, you know, with the, I guess, progression of the internet, social media, and what it is today, that, I mean, that becomes America's most wanted, right? I mean, we saw that even in the recent shooting in Michigan State, where,
yes. Yes.
Right? So that's what it's become, is social media has become America's most wanted in many ways. So this is a really, really interesting story. So when you think about like the case today, well, like what comes to your mind? Do you think about the family? Do you think about the work? Do you think about, you know, the investigation? And, you know, it's just obviously from my perspective, very.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the young girl, Francine Smith, when you look at that, when Seymour Pinckney was arrested 13 years later, she was a young mom with three children of her own. But she got to know that this man was brought to justice, and she never had to worry about him again, you know, because he was sentenced to life imprisonment. And at first he wanted to plead insanity, but then eventually he pled guilty to both the murders, and was sentenced. And obviously, you know, she lost her mom and her sister, but at least I think she never had to worry or look over her shoulder knowing that he was behind bars.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I mean, it's a great, I'm sure it's a great feeling that you were able to play a role in that. So that's really just a very, very interesting story. So I'm thinking about the way you guys handle the investigation, many of the things that you describe, right? It's funny because, you know, again, there's a lot more tools, a lot more technology, a lot more. But, you know, when you think about an investigation and how you guys ultimately captured it, fundamentally, I mean, what's done today is what was done at that time, right? I just find that to be interesting. Again, there's different tools, but essentially that's the way things are still done, the way you guys chase leads and followed them and work together and all those kind of things, right?
Well, I think the evolution, Farhad, of the joint task force, whether it be the joint, which I was involved in the beginning with the terrorism task force working out of New Jersey, when they had the killing of the New Jersey State Trooper by top 10 fugitives, the Trooper LaMonaco. When you work together on a part of a task force, a lot of the differences evaporate. Where years ago the FBI would work a case, they really didn't depend too much on the local authorities because they had the resources of the bureau. But I think the realization was that if everybody works together, there's so many things that can be done. And obviously the FBI, of when you work with a local police department, whether it be the a large urban department, the New York City Police Department, they're just an excellent police department. They do a great job. They have tremendous resources of their own, both domestically and internationally. But when you have the FBI working with you as well, you have access to all of the 57 field offices, all the foreign legal attaches, and you have the resources of the FBI lab, the FBI identification division, premier support factors with all the resources that the FBI has. I mean, here's a case with one of the very first cases they ever used computerized enhancing of the photograph. And Jim Buckley and myself, it's really ironic. The two of us looked at the photograph. We said, "Nah, he's not going to look like that." And we were like, between us, we were like a little critical of the artist at the time. And then we drove down that night, and we saw Seymour Pinckney the night he was arrested. Right after the show, we drove. It was like an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever, to get to the location where he was in custody. And we looked at him, and we looked at each other, and I think Jimmy called the agent who did the enhancement and said, "I think I owe you an apology. I didn't think he was going to look like he did." But sure enough, it was amazing. So that computerized enhancing really did work, taking those factors of him being a heavy drinker, heavy smoker, his lifestyle, and sure enough, it looked just like him.
That's a really interesting that's a really interesting commentary. So you kind of actually led into what I was going to ask you about next, right? So obviously you've built a very, very successful career in both the public and private sectors, right? And as we've already discussed, and throughout this discussion, you have mentioned, what's always stuck out to me is your ability to maintain, well, build and maintain relationships, right? So, how important do you think that has been to your success?
Well, I think it's a measure of success for anyone. I've been fortunate enough, but I learned at a young age, from the values of my mother and my family and people that were important in my life, the importance of keeping your word. If you tell somebody you're going to do something, if they know they can depend on you, if they know that it's not a lot of hot air, that if somebody calls you, no matter who calls me, I always make it my business to return a phone call, no matter who it is. And I think if you stay with those basic courtesies, and what I found what's so important is if you don't worry about who's going to get the credit in a case, people sense that. And and I think there's so much of a better opportunity, for teamwork to really take place and people to value those, and from teamwork you develop those friendships. And these are lasting friendships. I had the liaison in the 70s with the New York City PD homicide zones up in the Bronx. There were three homicide zones, the 7th, the 8th, and the 9th. And here I am, a young agent, and I'm going to speak at each of those three homicide zones, and to veteran New York City police officers who really, in some cases, didn't have a good experience with the FBI and didn't like the FBI. And I would tell them, I'm willing to take any of your fugitive cases where you think the individual committed a murder and fled the jurisdiction of New York. I'm willing to go present the case to the U.S. Attorney's Office and to obtain a federal unlawful flight warrant if you want the assistance. And sure enough, in 1 year, we had my partner at that time, Dan McLaughlin, who's since long retired, a Bronx guy. We got 30-something warrants, UFAP warrants, and caught almost every one of the guys. Working with the detectives, caught them, whether it would be in Detroit and California and Puerto Rico and wherever it was. We had the resources of the FBI. And I think a lot of these veteran detectives saw the value of it. And we shared, when there was press releases, we shared that information. We didn't say the FBI made the arrest, through a joint investigation with the New York City Police Department, 7th Homicide Zone, and the FBI. And it was great cooperation. Then in 77, when you had the Son of Sam cases, I had the honor and pleasure of working with, and this is how relationships start. There was a young lieutenant by the name of Kevin Hallinan in the 8th Homicide Zone, and he worked for a great captain by the name of Powers. And they had asked me, they had a great group of detectives up there. They had some items with the Son of Sam case that they wanted to expedite, with some evidence. And I remember it wasn't anything really special, but we tried to help them in any way that we could. They did a great job, the detectives, and you develop those friendships. And here it is later on, many years later, when Kevin Hallinan is offered the position as the head of security for Major League Baseball. He offers me a job when I retired from the FBI to become his director, his assistant. And so that's an example of, and I always tell, I often speak to high school groups, and I enjoy talking to young people about the FBI because I have such, great memories and such great association with people of the FBI, and I tell them what a great career opportunity it is for, men, women, young people, whether it be a support capacity or as an agent. But there's so much good that can come from working with others and learning from them and sharing those experiences, and that's what I think. I'm touch with some of the guys that I worked with from years ago from New York, particularly Kevin Hallinan, who just wrote a great book entitled Over the Wall. It's a terrific book about his experiences as a New York City detective, which he was a great one, and his brother Tommy Hallinan was another great detective, two brothers, and it's a great book. And there's a number of parts that he referenced where I worked with both the brothers, but that's what made the job enjoyable, and it made you feel like a sense of accomplishment when you took a murderer off the streets or a kidnapper, someone who committed a violent crime. You felt like you were getting something done. You were making a contribution, and I think that's what made the FBI special for me. That I look forward to going to work every day.
I mean, again, just all fantastic feedback. I'm looking forward to hearing some of the feedback we get on this episode, because I'm sure it'll be terrific. But we usually end the show with takeaways, right? And you've been one step ahead of me the entire show, and no difference about the ending. But what I was going to ask you to talk about is, if you had advice, if you had one or two pieces of advice for young people today that are either in law enforcement thinking about it, or just in the private sector that are sort of, you know, again, in the early stages of their career, what would those things be?
Well, it's a great question, Farhad. And I think I have an interesting answer. I was asked twice to be the speaker at the Morris County Police Academy graduation. It was a very large class. There were probably about 600 or 700 people in the audience. And I wanted to convey a message that was special. So it was a simple idea that I had. I reached out to detectives, people that I worked with in large urban departments like New York City, Jersey City, to suburban areas, to rural areas, you know, from the one end of the spectrum to the other. And I asked them a very simple question. If your son or daughter was graduating from this police academy, what would be one of the most important things that you would want them to learn? What would you convey to them? And I couldn't believe the great response. Now, I talked to a guy who was a police officer, just a patrol officer in a small suburban community, very small community. And he had such a valuable piece of advice. He said, you know, you can stop a car, you know, car stops, he said, 99 times and never have a problem. He said, don't ever let it become routine, because that 100th stop could be a guy that is wanted for bank robbery, murder, a violent criminal, and your life could be at stake in the life of others. What a great piece of advice from a guy who was a patrol officer in a small town. Then I talked to a trooper who covered rural areas of New Jersey, and he said, you know, I would tell the young guys who came on the job, he said, you might get a call from an elderly woman. Somebody broke her window. You know, might be a little vandalism or something. He says, treat that woman as if it was your mother, how you would want your mother treated. And the advice from each of the detectives, I was able to, you know, provide that in my talk and touch upon the things that, you know, you want to, when you want to, if you treat people with respect, even I was always very successful with getting confessions with people because I would treat them with respect, even if it was a criminal. If you treat people with respect, and then later on, you know, for example, if I went and spoke to the mother of a fugitive, I would say, look, you know, I don't want this to end in tragedy. I don't want an innocent police officer or an innocent person getting killed. And you don't want your son to be killed. Help us. And I guarantee you that I'll treat your son with fairness. And if you cooperate, I'll keep my word to you. And I can't tell you how many times I got people to cooperate. And then when you sit down with someone and you interview them, if you treat them with fairness, you know, you get them a cup of coffee, a roll in butter or a donut, whatever, and you sit and you say, look, you know, you got an opportunity here to clear the slate. You have an opportunity to cooperate. You know, we have a very good case against you. You're going to probably be found guilty. Cooperate. If there's any other people involved, tell us, and in the long run, it can help you out. And as a result, Farhad, over the years, I wound up with people in the prison contacting me with information that they thought I could use. And I think it's if you build those relationships, you treat people, no matter who they are, if you treat them with respect and fairness, not every time, but so often you'll get it in return. And I think that's an important lesson that you want to convey to any young person. And I would encourage anyone, despite all the negative publicity, I still think the FBI is one of the greatest jobs. If I had to do over again, I wouldn't hesitate for a minute. I would love being an FBI agent all over again. And as exciting as baseball was and the NFL, in my opinion, couldn't compare with being an FBI agent.
That's just such I mean it's you're talking about the FBI, but it really is very neat to hear someone talk about their sort of career and life that way. And hopefully some of the folks that are currently in the FBI will listen to this and maybe it'll spark something. You just never know. I mean maybe it will. So I really thank you so much, Ed. This was just an fantastic episode, and I really enjoyed, as I always do, sitting down and speaking to you. This time we were recording, but it felt the same. So thank you so much for joining me, and I hope to talk to you again soon. So thank you so much.
I mean, you know how I think about you, and we've had a long-term friendship, and I'm happy to say, and I hold you in high regard. And it was so nice getting a chance to meet your son at the FBI Academy. What a nice young man he is, and what a great bright future he has. So it's my pleasure to be a guest on your show.
Thank you so much, Ed.
Don't forget to follow us. We are on LinkedIn and Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.